You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 9th, 2008, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. Joining me this evening are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Oh, and tonight we recognize the passing of Paul Baroka on this day in 1880.
Yes. And his brain.
And his brain.
That's right. Baroka's Brain, the title of an excellent book by Carl Sagan. Mm-hmm. That's the guy who figured out that that bit of the brain is responsible for motor verbal output.
And then he named that bit of the brain Baroka's area or
right.
something like that.
That's all Baroka's area,
so
right?
Full of himself, that Baroka. Yeah. There's always Baroka this and Baroka that. And, oh, look at my brain. Shut up, Baroka.
You're just jealous that you don't have a piece of the human anatomy named after you yet.
Actually, it's funny you should bring it up. No, actually, let's not go there.
Yeah, isn't there Rebecca's Bits or something?
Rebecca's Bits?
Yes, I keep them in a jar by my bed.
With the kibbles.
Well, we have a few news items this week, and then we're going to play an interview with James Randi that we recorded at TAM recently. But first, Einstein, you remember him, Albert Einstein, has been proven right yet again.
I'm sure he's relieved.
He's very relieved. So his special and general theories of relativity have pretty much passed every test that's come down the pike. Every time physicists figure out a way to make an observation that would test the predictions of the theories of relativity, they turn out to be correct, and this has happened yet again. Ironically, the first real test of the general theory of relativity was the 1919 solar eclipse, and that was the one that made Einstein a household name. And this time around, another eclipse has offered up a test for general relativity. This is really cool. Astronomers have found a pair of pulsars orbiting each other. Pulsars are spinning neutron stars that are shooting out X-rays like from the poles of the axis of their spin. And if they happen to be pointing at us, they pulsate, right? So that, hence the name pulsars. In fact, when they were first discovered, this regular pulsing, they were called LGMs for little green men, because we thought, hey, that might be an intelligent signal. It's this regularly spaced signal. But then we figured out that they were pulsars.
And they turned out to be really handy for discovering new things, including this most recent.
Oh, yeah. So they discovered a system with two pulsars rotating around each other. But not only that, the plane of their rotation pretty much points right at the Earth. So one pulsar will eclipse the other, you know, as it passes as they pass in front and behind each other. This gives us an opportunity to test a prediction of the general theory of relativity about the effect of gravity on these massive objects revolving around each other. And the observations, yet again, exactly match the predictions of general relativity. And they had to match not only just in what was happening, but mathematically. You know, the numbers had to add up. These that Einstein's equations were shown to be accurate, not just the broad brushstrokes.
But is anybody surprised?
No, I don't think so. But, you know, you never know. I think, you know, physicists are half hoping that they'll find an anomaly that doesn't fit, because then they could – that would be a big clue as to a deeper formula or a deeper principle that it may even give us an opportunity to tie together – gravity with quantum effects, you know, that elusive quantum gravity that physicists haven't been able to get a handle on yet. But when the theories of relativity are confirmed, it's nice, but it doesn't give us an opportunity to develop a deeper theory, because, you know, anomalies are helpful in that way. You know, if you find something that doesn't fit into the existing framework, that tells you something about how you need to change it in order to find the deeper hidden unity in nature.
Are there any other specific predictions of general relativity that we're keeping an eye open for an event to happen so that we can further confirm it?
That's a really good question.
Yeah, that is a good question.
I don't know off the top of my head.
I'm sure there are.
What about gravity waves? Are we still waiting for some stuff?
Yes, gravity waves, yep.
Yeah, that's the only thing that occurred to me, but I don't know offhand what the specific experiment would be that would confirm it, but I think that's part of prediction from general relativity.
That's such a subtle effect that it's very difficult to reproduce. Some of the plans they've got planned now involve, say, three satellites that are in a specific configuration connected by laser beams, and then at like right angles or whatever. I guess you would need four then for that. But the distance between two of the satellites would change minutely if gravity waves passed by them. It seems subtle enough to be able to detect it. And hopefully once we get those satellites up there, we'll confirm it. And that would be quite an event. I'm looking forward to that.
And as much fun as it would be to find an anomaly, it is kind of cool when you see something that's kind of simple and elegant, like what, well, simple, relatively, haha, speaking. But something as elegant as what Einstein came up with, when you see it, that it just works. Science works every now and again, which is kind of awesome. And to the listeners who are going to be pedantic, I was joking about that every now and again.
Yeah.
I know that science works. Oh, and a funny thing about this story is that I was on the train ride from hell Sunday. I was stuck on this Amtrak train for 3 hours while, I don't know, they fixed an engine or something. And I happened to pick up a Wi-Fi signal, and I saw Steve's blog entry about this very thing. And a little while later, the guys behind me started talking about astrophysics, because one kid is studying astrophysics at Brown. And it was kind of funny to hear them suddenly talking about stuff like that. And I was able to pop in and say, hey, guess what? And share the little tidbit of wisdom. And they said they'd check out the podcast. So if you're listening, guys, hello, strangers from the
cool.
train who like astrophysics.
Rebecca, you're not supposed to talk to guys on the train.
What are you talking about?
They could be perverts conducting experiments, much the way Einstein conducted thought experiments involving trains and so forth.
Is that would that be called the 5 foot club?
I'm trying to think of a joke about how I was moving so fast, but it looked slower from outside. But I.
Now, Rebecca, did they offer to show you their Doppler shift? I'm just curious.
Good.
Hey, that line always works for me. Anyway, the next item is about the...
you're so lucky you're married.
I know. The Conservapedia. Now, this is... I'd written about this before, but the Conservapedia is a Wikipedia... But filled with conservative propaganda.
It's dumb.
It's like, we're going to have our own encyclopedia where we change the truth to fit our political ideology. It's like, I mean, it's absurd. And recently, they did not like the recent bacterial experiments that we discussed a few weeks ago.
Yeah, they did not like that at all. The Conservapedia founder, Andrew Schlafly, attempted a stunt of sorts to discredit that recent experiment on evolution that was done. And this stunt went awry and lit up many science blogs. It started with that E. coli experiment Steve referred to a moment ago. We covered that a few episodes ago, I believe. That's the one where Dr. Richard Lenski and his team tracked 30,000 generations of bacteria over 20 years. Now, the gist of that experiment is worth going over again real fast. What happened was he created a generation or a population of bacteria that evolved the ability to metabolize citrate, which citrate is basically citric acid in a kind of like a salt-like form. That might not sound like too much, but it's an incredible mutation, actually, since not being able to metabolize citrate is one of the defining characteristics of E. coli. In fact, according to New Scientist, it's the first time evolution has been caught in the act of making such a rare and complex new trait. Now, the fun really started when the news of this experiment reached the ears of Conservapedia and its founder, Andrew Schlafly. As Steve said, it's a wiki-style encyclopedia. It started in 2006, mainly as a counter, as far as I could tell, as a counter to Wikipedia, which was seen as increasingly anti-Christian and anti-American. If you've read any of the Conservapedia's science articles, you know why I call the site Constipedia. Many articles support Many articles support a young Earth creationist viewpoint. For example, their article on kangaroos claims that all kangaroos descend from a single pair that was on Noah's Ark. And just a quick scan of Conservapedia produced this little gem of a quote. There is little scientific consensus on how macroevolution is said to have happened. And then, of course, they follow that quote with that tried and true technique of using out of context quotes from scientists. Really compelling stuff. So it's no surprise that Schlafly had a major problem with Lenski's experiment, and he wrote him a letter. And in it, he said, "Skepticism has been expressed on Conservapedia about your claim and the significance of your claims that E. coli bacteria had an evolutionary beneficial mutation in your study." And then he goes off saying that basically, because you're publicly funded, you send me all your data. Lenski then replied very politely that the data he needs is in the paper, and the bacterial strains necessary to duplicate his experiment would be willingly shared, but only with qualified researchers.
Schlafly seems to have missed the fact that the data is actually stored as frozen samples of the bacteria all throughout the experiment. It's not
exactly.
Just numbers on a notebook. The actual bacteria are actually stored.
Right.
It's there.
Right. Schlafly doesn't seem to realize that the data in the actual paper, the submitted paper, is pretty much all he should need, unless he really and truly wants to actually start messing with bacteria, which of course he is not qualified to do at all. And then this went back and forth a few times. Schlafly sent another letter pretty much ignoring what Lenski had said and saying again, you know, give me all your taxpayer-funded research. But by this time, Lenski was a little more savvy with what was going on, and he knew what he was dealing with. And he said that, "I tried to be polite, civil, and respectful in reply to your first email, despite its rude tone and uninformed content." And then he comes out with some great stuff here. He says to Schlafly, "First, it seems that reading might not be your strong suit, given your initial letter, which showed you had not read our paper. If you had not even read the original paper, how do you have any basis of understanding from which to question, much less criticize the data that are presented therein?" And then he goes off smacking him here and there. And then he ends it in this great little paragraph here. He says, "But perhaps because you did not bother even to read our paper, or perhaps because you aren't very bright, you seem not to understand that we have the actual living bacteria that exhibit the properties reported in our paper, including both the ancestral strain used to start the long-term experiment and its evolved citrate using descendants. In other words, it's not that we claim to have glimpsed a unicorn in the garden. We have a whole population of them living in my lab."
And then he
says, "Unless you accuse me further of fraud, I do not literally mean that we have unicorns in the lab. Rather, I'm making a literary allusion." And then he's got a Wikipedia link, now, which of course is a nice smack in the face that it's a Wikipedia link, because, you know, they hate Wikipedia over there.
I love him so much.
Hypocritical is that?
So Lenski's awesome. He gives him a great smackdown.
He filleted him.
And it's just a fun thing to follow. And he just, I mean, everything, it seems like everything that Schlafly did was calculated to have the opposite effect that he really wanted it to have. I mean, he made...
All right, we can get a good laugh at this, and it's absolutely right that he's not going to convince anybody who has any scientific savvy or skeptical savvy. But this was all for the benefit of the know-nothing creationists to provide plausible deniability. Don't worry about all this slam dunk evidence for evolution that the media is talking about. I'm going to, you know, whine and cry and make false accusations of fraud enough to generate this cloud of confusion that you can hide behind and have plausible deniability.
But the funny thing is that didn't even work. Like, you look at the creationists, and for the most part, the people who comment on the douchebags' postings, like, they pretty much are all saying, well, you know, he has a point. Oh, I see what he's talking about there. Like, they're actually starting to think for themselves, which just makes Lenski all the more amazing to me.
But, well done, Mr. Lenski. Conservapedia, bad idea. That's basically the embodiment of subjugating science and objectivity to ideology.
It's also a very good study of logical fallacy.
All right, next news item. The National Institute of Mental Health is considering, in fact, they've proposed a study to test chelation, oral chelation, for autism. This is an extremely controversial proposal. This goes back to the claim that autism, at least in part, may be caused by mercury poisoning, which may in turn be linked to vaccines. And we've discussed this numerous times on the podcast, the fact that there probably is no real autism epidemic, that the increase in the number of diagnoses is due to increased surveillance and a broadening diagnosis, that the evidence is absolutely solid that there is no link between autism and vaccines. When mercury was in thimerosal was removed from vaccines in the U.S. by 2002, autism rates continued to rise at the exact same slope they were before, so there wasn't even a blip in the data. You know, it's 6 years after removing the almost all of the thimerosal. If that were the toxic agent that was at all tied to autism, you would have seen an effect on the data, and there wasn't the slightest blip. So that pretty much was the final nail in the coffin for that hypothesis. But now there are a number of parents who claim that chelation therapy, which is removing mercury, which is probably not even there, is helping their children with autism. So the question is this study even ethical? And this gets into the whole notion of medical ethics. You know, can you do an implausible research study on human subjects, especially children who are unable to give their own informed consent, so they are considered to be a vulnerable population, and therefore we need to be all the more careful in protecting their rights? I think this study would be utterly unethical. It's an implausible therapy. There's really no science behind it. The only reason for it is politics. Again, we see politics trumping science. Unfortunately, the head of the NIMH is supporting this study. Thomas Insull is quoted as saying, "So many moms have said it saved my kids. This is an urgent set of questions. Let's make innovation the centerpiece of this effort as we study autism, its causes and treatments, and think of what we may be missing." He's basically making an argument for why we should try this highly implausible therapy. The other problem with doing this research, not only is that it's unethical, is that it doesn't do any good. The people who are promoting this are not science-based. They're not evidence-based. A negative study will not affect them one way or the other. It's a lose-lose proposition. You know, it's basically doing scientific research in an unscientific arena. Doesn't help. It wastes money. There's all risk, no benefit. The National Center for Complementary and Alternative Medicine has now spent hundreds of millions of dollars over more than a decade, and they haven't, as a result of a string of negative research, there isn't a single so-called alternative modality which the proponents have abandoned or stopped using as a result of scientific evidence. At the same time, they haven't proven that anything works sufficiently to convince the scientific community. So they haven't produced any evidence of efficacy adding a new treatment to our arsenal. And neither have the negative evidence convinced the proponents to stop using it. So the effect on the practice of the modalities under study is zero, which means that the research has been an entire and complete waste of time, money, and all the risks of doing that study in terms of the subjects involved.
So that's a very interesting point of view, though, Steve. I mean, if we really think about that, then maybe we need to consider refocusing our general skeptical efforts on different things.
What do you mean?
Like, in other words, if this study or if this the fact that you just brought up is in any way indicative of, you know, what it is in the general population, with anything, with any piece of information like this or any pseudoscience that's being studied or whatever, it makes me want to like rethink how we spend our energy and how we.
Well, I'll be honest with you. Within those people in the skeptical movement who are focused on science-based medicine, who are trying to fight pseudoscience within the medical field, the mood is very dim. It's very doom and gloom recently. One of my co-bloggers, David Gorski, wrote a blog entry called "Resistance is Futile," basically saying that science is irrelevant. Society has essentially decided that pseudoscience and woo and nonsense is all okay, and nobody basically cares, you know, if medicine is science-based or not. We've basically already lost, and there's really nothing that we can do about it.
Screw that. That's the same. You know, to me, that's a useless attitude to even have.
I agree. Like, I agree.
If you have that, it's basically, to me, it's like kind of like when people say, anything we don't know about science, well, God did it. It's giving up. It's like, why bother? And I think that for us to keep doing what we're doing, we have to stay positive. And, you know, it's definitely not all for nothing. I mean, we get emails every day from people who are learning more and more and want to keep learning more and more about the universe. And, you know, we're helping them do that. And Skeptic Magazine and Skeptical Inquirer and all the other podcasts and stuff, it's, you know, it's having an effect. So just because Jenny McCarthy is making headlines every now and again for doing something stupid doesn't mean that tomorrow won't be a little bit better and the day after that a little bit better as well. I think that people do still want to learn. They still want the truth. And, you know, we can't give up so easily. I think we're living in a time when we've banished more superstition than, you know, any previous era. I mean, I think in general, science is still going. We're still discovering
definitely.
New things.
You know, the thing is, though, Rebecca, I think it's perfectly legitimate for us to acknowledge the fact that it is extremely frustrating and an enormous amount of energy is wasted on trying to help educate people that can't listen. I think that's the point that's trying to be made here, is that there are people that can listen and that want to learn and legitimately have their minds open appropriately, and then there are people that can't listen. And there's a big difference. And those people
But I think that I think that the unreachable people are rarer than you might think. And if some people want to give up on them, then that's fine. I'm sure that there will be other people who will keep picking up those people. And some of those will change their mind and start learning things. I think there's a very, very small percentage of people who are just completely deluded and 100% that, you know, convinced in some kind of delusion. But, you know, we talk a lot about how people shouldn't bother getting into big arguments with true believers. And I believe that. I think that you're never going to change a true believer's mind by, you know, yelling at them or something. But I think that there's a way to reach just about everybody. And I think it's important that we all just keep doing the best we can to do that. And, you know, that might mean doing a comedy show on Comedy Central, or it might mean doing a podcast or doing a blog that focuses on, you know, a specific part of the population. You know, if a particular portion of the population is that frustrating, then, you know, screw it. Don't bother with that. Change your focus to people that you do think you can help. And I agree with
that. Well, that's what I'm saying too. And I agree with everything that you're saying. But what I was commenting on earlier before, what Steve was saying, is that we need to look at what we're doing, how we're spending our time, how we're spending our energy, and possibly refocus it in different areas that would bear more fruit. And I'm maybe not even people that do what we do, Rebecca, but, you know, could you imagine being one of those researchers who put the time, money, and energy into disproving or just trying to get good, positive results out of their research to get some conclusion? They find a conclusion, and what Steve said was the conclusion was completely ignored. It was utterly ignored.
But I don't – that doesn't mean – does that mean we should stop coming up with the solutions?
No, not at all. But I think though
– it just means we need to and I think we agree on this. We just need to figure out how we can communicate those solutions to people so that they understand them and accept them.
But nobody's
saying
that. It doesn't necessarily mean that. Like, who is trying to figure that out? Nobody's doing it. Nobody in the skeptical
Hang on. Let me tell you where things are right now.
Okay, go ahead.
I was talking not about the overall skeptical movement, but just about within scientific medicine, right? Just that one slice of it. I think there are other venues where we're winning. I think with evolution versus creationism, intelligent design, I think we're kicking their asses, to be honest with you. We're doing a great job. They're failing. And we're winning all the important battles, all of the legal battles. If you look at alternative medicine versus science-based medicine, I think we're getting our asses kicked. That's by any objective measure. Yeah. The con artists have gotten very savvy, and they have come up with a lot of politically winning strategies. And we are fighting an uphill battle every way, and we're losing ground. By any measure, regulations are going against us. They're infiltrating academia at every level. they are have figured out how to form their own journals, their own departments. Even I'm fighting this now within Yale. I'm having to fight the infiltration of the worst kind of pseudoscience. And so far, I'm trying not to talk about this too much because I'm actually actively engaged in this. So far, there is this prevailing almost apathy about it among professionals, which is incredibly frustrating. And those of us who are working against it aren't giving up. Certainly, you know, I will go to my deathbed fighting pseudoscience within my own profession. I don't care how much I lose. And that's because I think, as you say, Rebecca, we do have our successes even on an individual level. If we weren't here doing what we were doing, it would be all the worse. Yep. And I also think there's the potential for long-term victory if we keep plugging away and plugging at it. We may have some short-term setbacks, but at the end of the day, science will out, and I think we need to be the ones who are continuing to plug away at this. But what we're talking about is really assessing the playing field and regrouping. You know, is saying, like Jay was saying, we have to rethink our strategy. I was just, you know, in an email exchange just today with some of my colleagues, and they said, we need to get together and figure out a new game plan because we're losing. You know, that's all. It's not giving up. It's more just acknowledging the realities.
And of course, I don't think that you would give up, but what you were saying about about your fellow blogger was
he was darker than I was. I mean, he was getting a little futile. Yeah.
But here's the other thing: is that what you're saying sounds to me exactly like what I've heard scientists say in other fields, particularly biology. I happen to know a lot of biologists, and a very good friend of mine told me a long time ago that 99% of the people he works with do not care about the creationists.
Right.
They don't think about it. They don't care. It's completely, they're completely apathetic. They go to work, they do their job, they do their tests, they go home, they don't care how it's received by the general public. And that to me sounds very similar to what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think that, but despite that, you know, we're still winning the fight against creationists. And so I think that a lot of that is due to the not just biologists getting excited about fighting creationism, but getting the general public excited about it. And I think that's where you come in, Steve,
right,
and your bloggers, is that, you know, you're doctors, but you have the ability to reach the general public and get them interested in it. And, you know, we did it with creationism. We can do it with alternative medicine.
I certainly hope so.
There's no doubt in my mind about it.
Yeah, I agree with you. That's obviously what we're trying to do. But it's while winning the fight in the creationist arena, we're losing it right now in the alternative medicine arena, and we have to figure out a way to turn the tide. I think we're seeing the beginnings of a backlash, and more people are starting to care, but we haven't reached critical mass yet where we could start to change the momentum. I'll let you know when that happens, but we're going to keep plugging away until we figure out how to change that momentum going back in the right direction. And the other problem is that, unlike creationism, where the mechanisms are in place, where every time a new creationist law is passed in just some little school board somewhere, we all hear about it immediately,
yep,
right?
Yeah.
With alternative medicine, they are passing these laws in the dead of night. They have a very deliberately stealth campaign going on, where state by state, institution by institution, they are infiltrating and they are changing the laws to their favor, and 99.9% of the public isn't even aware it's happening and that these laws exist. It's happening right under our noses. And that's what we have to figure out first and foremost, is how to make the public aware that this is even happening.
And why they should care.
And why they should care. That's that too. That's because it's complicated. It's really complicated to get people to understand why, you know, it's not okay to do a treatment just because it feels good. You know, that the science actually matters. It's really complicated.
Is this a matter of, let's say we had some funds available, right? Let's say that huge donations were made. I mean, would it be a matter of money? Like, is that a huge obstacle?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And here's the other thing, Jay. You bring up money. There are organizations like the Bravewell Organization. This is an endowment with millions of dollars. I think, hundreds of millions of dollars. And what they do is they'll go to a university and they'll bribe them with money in order to set up these ideological, spiritually based, you know, medical departments and programs and research. So they are using money. They are using money to change the standards within medicine and academia, and it's working because nobody right now can afford to turn down a check for millions of dollars just based upon principle. So it's hard for us to fight against these well-funded organizations. They're basically – the Bravewell is actually like the equivalent of the Discovery Institute for Intelligent Design,
yep.
except they know what they're doing and they're succeeding.
Wow.
One more aspect in regards to the money, though, Steve, is the insurance companies. You know, insurance companies that would rather see someone go to a chiropractor for a few hundred bucks as opposed to going to real doctors for thousands of dollars. So there's so many fronts of this battle of alternative medicine.
It really makes
the creationism debates look kind of small when you line them up next to each other.
I agree.
So something's got to be done.
Well, we'll keep fighting the good fight. We have a special report this week from Evan honoring the 61st anniversary of Roswell. Evan, take it away.
You give it too much credit by calling it honoring. this week in 1947, a gentleman by the name of William Mack Brazel, who was a foreman of the Foster Ranch, about 60 miles north of Roswell, New Mexico, discovered some debris on the ranch that he was taking care of. And it was material that most people had never, ever seen before. Air Force officials were brought in to clean up the debris and gather it away. Although people didn't know for many, many years, those were the seeds of the phenomenon that is Roswell as we know it today. Did you guys know that this really didn't become a controversy or a real hot topic of ufologists and so forth until really 1980?
The 70s, wasn't it?
Late 70s, but in 1980, a book was published by a couple of ufologists, Charles Berlitz and William Moore, and they specifically talked about the Roswell incident in that book, and that sort of, you know, in the age of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, late 70s, UFO mania is kind of, you know, taking the country by storm, and bam, here comes this book on Roswell, and, you know, really history was kind of made then. And what they did is they went back and to collect information. When they were collecting information from this book, they were interviewing people who were involved in the project that was going on at the time, back in 1947, which local people were seeing, you know, aircraft and other things happening, you know, witness accounts to these strange things going on, strange sights in the sky and so forth. And they're basically taking these interviews and fabricating a story based on people's 30-year-old memories of what happened. And what they did is they pieced together a story, wove a story, that a flying saucer or an extraterrestrial spacecraft is actually what crashed on that farm. And the Air Force was brought in to clean up the debris and do the cover-up, the government conspiracy angle of this. So really, since 1980 just to today, you know, less than 30 years. And think about how much Roswell is ingrained in our culture, is ingrained in so many aspects of our society, entertainment, and so forth. And it's really become a household name, and it is the modern American mythology of pseudoscience. It's become larger than life.
It's interesting how, you know, you could see a myth develop in, you know, our own lifetimes, you know, in recorded history. And you imagine, you know, how hundreds and thousands of years ago how stories developed and evolved, you know, into, well, you know, this, you know, makes it all the more clear. You have really a non-event that happened, you know, 30 years prior to when the story first became famous, and it was like a two-day news cycle. And then it turned into nothing, and then it was really, and then all the mythology was manufactured pretty much out of whole cloth by more modern ufologists. It's just incredible.
In 1994, information became declassified by the U.S. Air Force, and they revealed that what occurred in 1947 was, and the crash and the debris and so forth, was part of a larger military project called Project Mogul. And the gentleman by the name of Charles B. Moore, at the time, he was one of the three surviving Project Mogul scientists at the time. He went on a, I'm not sure if it was a lecture tour or not, but in any case, he gave some public testimony as to his involvement in the project now that it was declassified, and, you know, told people basically exactly what was going on. He said the unclassified purpose of the project was to develop constant level balloons for meteorological purposes. That was the unclassified purposes. But its true classified purpose was to develop a way to monitor possible Soviet nuclear detonations with the use of low-frequency acoustic microphones placed at high altitudes. At the time, no other means of monitoring nuclear activities of a country like Russia or the Soviet Union was available. So the project was given high priority and high classification. It was a very secret. It was a very secret project. Now, what happened is one of these balloons. They sent up many of these balloons over the course of a couple of months, and of course, one of them, of course, did crash. This was in mid June is when they estimated that this particular balloon went down, and then the remains were found. The Air Force did come in and they did take it all away, and they did try to cover it up as best as they can, but only because it was a secret spying. Audio spying balloon.
Yeah.
Not because of crashed saucers or alien bodies or anything like that. And unfortunately, how it got reported the next day in the paper on July 8th, 1947, is that the Air Force basically said that they had, that in order to help with their cover up, not wanting people to know exactly what it was, that it was a flying craft of some sort crashed, and
they actually used the term flying saucer.
Did they use flying saucer?
They did, and you have to understand that this was right after the modern flying saucer myth began. This was right after
Kenneth Arnold.
Right after Kenneth Arnold, you know, and the term flying saucer was coined. So it was still very new in the public consciousness. They didn't necessarily think of what we think of when we hear the term flying saucer. And it was like, oh, that's one of them flying saucers, meaning one of them strange things in the sky that nobody knows what
they are. That's right, Steve. And it was interesting because the Kenneth Arnold incident happened in June of 47. So there were these couple of weeks in which there were these it happened to be these reports of various, you know, things in the sky, the whole flying saucer thing. And apparently there were hundreds of reports nationwide describing flying quote-unquote saucers, like you said. So it was this time of activity just because of the media at the time, and it sort of was born out of this.
And then as new bits were added to the UFO myth, they were retrofitted into the Roswell story, like aliens, little gray aliens. There was no report of little gray aliens for 30 years. It was retrofitted after the whole abduction thing started going and people started reporting little gray aliens.
Right. But I thought those came from the test they did with those little, like, 3 foot tall fake army men that they were parachuting or putting into some of these balloons.
Yeah, that's interesting that
you ever hear about
that? Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, Jay, because actually that did those dummies or crash test dummies that basically the Air Force was using at the time were actually being used in other projects, not the Project Mogul project. But with memories 30 years old and so forth, you take these little pieces of different projects of these people that we're involved with, and you make a new story out of it. You weave it all together, and it's called retrospective falsification. Process of telling a story that is factual to some extent, but it gets distorted and falsified over time as it gets embellished and things get added. And in the end, what you have is a total story, just a fiction derived from little parts of true events that happened from the various sources. Well, let me wrap it up with this, but going back to Charles Moore, who was one of the Project Mogul scientists. This was what he had to say in 1994, summing things up. When the wind information, reports about wind information that of those days that they were doing the tests, is coupled with the similarities in the debris described by the eyewitnesses, hence the balsa sticks, the tin foil, the tape with pastel pinkish purple flowers, the smoky gray balloon rubber with a burnt odor, the eyelets, tough paper, 4-inch diameter aluminum pieces, and a black box, the materials used in the balloon flight trains, it appears to me that it would be difficult to exclude these Project Mogul as a likely source of the debris that Brazel found on the Foster Ranch in 1947. So he says that is totally consistent with exactly what happened on that day back in July 7th of 1947. And, you know, frankly, that's good enough for me.
It's certainly the most plausible explanation. And there's nothing we should say. There's no evidence of anything demonstrably alien or anything that contradicts
yep.
that story. You know, of course, if you discount just anecdotal evidence, just eyewitness testimony, but there's no physical evidence that would dispute that.
One of the stories that came out of this whole thing, I love the whole the tape that the research scientists were mm-hmm. using on the balloons, and one of the people that found some of the debris from one of the crash sites said it was alien hieroglyphics, and it ended up being kids' tape that had funny symbols
yep.
on it.
Like bunny rabbits.
Flowery
and stuff,
sorts
yeah.
of yeah, little hearts and stuff. I'm actually.
Alien yeah, hieroglyphics.
They call that alien. Yeah, the UFOlogists say that's alien hieroglyphics.
That's ghost cold.
That's ghost cold, right. Yes, it's called an active imagination. Well, thanks, Evan.
Sure.
And let's go on to our interview. We are joined now by the man himself, James Randi. Randi, thanks again for joining us at the Skeptic's Guide.
A pleasure to be here, Steve, and it's been a while.
It has been. Yes, it has been. And we're, of course, here at the Amazing Meeting 6, and it's shaping up so far to be the best of the bunch. And so how do you think it's going?
Well, I think we'll probably we may pass 900, but we'll get very close to it if we don't. But that means next year, naturally, we'll have to do 1,000.
We'll have to break 1,000.
So we'll have to work extra hard. Linda and Carl are here, of course, working themselves to the bone, and Jeff Wagg and all of our volunteers, and Sean McCabe is a new intern at the foundation, and he has been a great volunteer. It's just so such a heady feeling to see mm-hmm. a room full of people who are really dedicated to making this thing work. And it's going to work handsomely. We have Neil deGrasse Tyson this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I've never met the gentleman, but I've seen him so often on television. He presents himself very well. And in his position, my goodness, you know, I used to hang out around the Hayden Planetarium. I was so happy to be there and such. And then they revamped it completely. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really been back since. But I think I might get a personalized tour the next time.
Excellent. Are you pretty much responsible for booking the guests, the big names like Neil deGrasse Tyson for the talk?
No, I'm not. I suggested Neil for this, and Linda and everybody else just pitched in and followed him down and tracked him down, trapped him, and got him to sign the paper. I should try to stay out of it,
mm-hmm.
Frankly, because I have certain prejudices in the field, you know, and mm-hmm. not only that, I really want to leave it to other people so that the thing is a project that's not just my baby. I want it to be a cooperative affair, and I think it's better that way.
Mm-hmm. And you envision that the amazing meeting going on indefinitely?
Well, I don't imagine myself going on indefinitely. recent experience has shown me that I'm a little vulnerable in that direction. But no, I would like it to go on as long as it possibly can, and even possibly after my demise, which will be coming up far, far, far in the future. I think it's a good idea. I think certainly we've built a reputation over the past few years. We have two things going for us, Steve. Well, many more than two, but two very good things going. We have attracted more women
mm-hmm.
and young people. And the young people don't just come along because they happen to be related necessarily to the older people. And the wives don't come along and represent the woman angle at all. Mm-hmm. Some of these women drag their husbands in
mm-hmm.
and everybody has a good time. So
that's probably because you're so hot.
That could be. Yes, yes. It's something I can't escape.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of those things. But we're very, very pleased that we have and increasingly minority groups. We have Afro-American folks that have come along over the past few years, and Hispanics. And that's hard to attract to the skeptical movement. Women are notoriously disinterested in the skeptical movement, I find. Have you found that yourself?
Generally speaking, yes, certainly statistically. And no one's really sure why.
No, it's a strange thing. I don't know whether it's something that that women think, oh, I guess the men can take care of that. I can't picture women thinking that way anymore.
My only guess is that skepticism by its very nature is a little confrontational, and, uh-huh. and it may not mesh well with the female way of dealing with things socially.
You mean moi? Confrontational? How could that possibly be?
And, you know, the women that I know who have been very active in the skeptical movement, they're like really good at networking and the social aspect of it.
Yes,
and,
yes,
and they're not as into the real confrontational part of it. So they have they have a different approach to the skeptical movement, one that's really greatly needed. And I think I agree, it's very good that we're attracting them into it because they bring something that I think a male-dominated group wouldn't have.
I don't know whether Amanovsky is feminine or not, but it might be. We'll not dwell on that.
Randy, how long has it been now since the Million Dollar Challenge has been given an end date? When was that? 3-4 months ago?
Yeah.
How's that going? Has the tone changed at all? And you know, there was a lot of backlash in the beginning. Where's it standing now?
There's been very little backlash. Well, we got the first flush of it, and people saying, "Aha! Now you're afraid that the prize is going, but it's going to be won." You know, we've never had that fear. Believe me, we've never had that fear. And as of March the 6th, 2 years from now, that'll make an even dozen years that we've dangled this carrot in front of them and challenged them to take it. And I think that proves our case pretty well. And we can use that money for better purposes. Yep. It's still our money, though it's been set aside presently in a separate account with Goldman Sachs that's called specifically the James Randi Educational Foundation Prize Account. And there was a time a few years ago that I had to put $20,000 of my own money into it simply because the market was so bad, the way the money was invested, that it dropped down below $1 million. And I said, no, we can't have that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
I popped the money in, and then several weeks later, I took it back out again.
Yeah.
So, but we've maintained the integrity of the account and of the challenge. But it simply has not paid off in any way that I can discern. We get only really crazy people apply.
Yep.
And people like Sylvia Brown, though she agreed to do it on the Larry King Live Show, what, 8-9 years ago now?
Yeah.
I've forgotten. That was in olden times. Even though she actually agreed, she was forced into it on the Larry King Show. She was confronted with it, and she couldn't resist, and she couldn't avoid agreeing to take the challenge, but then she never did, of course.
Right.
I don't know whether you know what her excuse was at first. She didn't know how to find me.
Right, I remember you saying that.
Right. Here's a psychic who talks to dead people, and I'm alive and in the phone book.
Yeah.
You know, and at that time, Google had 1.4 million references to James Randi, and most of them have my phone number in them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and so Sylvia, the great psychic, couldn't locate me somehow. She talks to dead people, but not me.
Yeah.
Randy, one of our listeners told us that they were signing up for TAM. They called down to the JREF offices, and lo and behold, you picked up the phone.
Yeah.
What's miraculous about that?
Yeah. Well, I'm saying, you're not a hard man to find.
Exactly.
Well,
that's the point.
Every now and then, you know, the lunches and things like that, and I stick around. I'm in there often by 7:30 in the morning and don't leave until about 9 at night. It's because I'm obsessive, I guess. I just got
dedicated.
So much to do.
Yeah.
Well, okay, let's put dedicated. That's a better word.
It's better spin.
I remember that.
Getting back to the TAM just for a minute, though, I think from my perspective, the one thing that TAM really represents, it's definitely evolved into the annual meeting of the skeptical movement. It has, I think, taken on proportions that go beyond one person, beyond even the JREF. I think this really, because there really is, and there also is no other annual meeting of the size and scope within the skeptical movement other than TAM. So that's how I think people view it. And I think for that reason, I foresee there'll be a huge pressure to keep it going.
I rather think so, Steve. And not only that, we are actively, in these few days that we have together, as a matter of fact, we are actively investigating the possibility of taking it to the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And or other European venues. Because if we were to go to the UK, we know that we would have great support from various groups over there and all through Europe. And we would attract a very large audience because it would be a short hop for them to come over to the UK. And I really very much want to do this. I think this would be an ideal venue for us. I feel so privileged in a way that all over the world, English is the second language now. And you go into the Scandinavian countries, you go every place but Spain, and perhaps Portugal as well, you find that English is so widely spoken, you can hardly find someone who won't understand what you're asking or inquiring about, whatever. It's sort of unfair, because when I was a teenager, it was French, the secondary language of the world, and of the United Nations at that time, and of the League of Nations at one time. You know, it's very strange that English has taken over as a universal language. My goodness, in Scandinavia, you can't walk down the street and buttonhole anybody that they don't understand every word you're speaking. It's a second language.
Well, it became the language of business.
Yes, there's that, and of science.
And then of the internet.
And of the internet. The internet has had a huge influence on that, of course. I wondered for a time until my Chinese friends leveled me out on it and led me to understand how they can get away with the Chinese language on the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, let's take a look at Google.
Yeah.
But of course, Google knows everything in every language. There's no question of that. There's no question that has not been answered, sometimes incorrectly. But a question that has not been answered by Google would be a very rare thing indeed. That's a very, very powerful influence. But how do you write Chinese on the internet? And there are so many ingenious ways around it. And the other problem with Chinese, of course, is that it has so many different dialects.
Yeah.
I've had my books published in the popular... No, well, not dialect, the representation in writing of my books. All my books have been published in Chinese. As a matter of fact, that happened in a very interesting way that I found out about that. I knew that I had sold the rights to all of my books to a Chinese agent there for $120. $120 for the whole thing, because that just paid my legal costs. I knew very well they were going to steal it otherwise. Yeah. And they do. They do, and I'm not speaking against them or anything. They just do that. That's the way it is. But I happened to be traveling first class, rare for me, a couple of years back, and there's a very attractive Chinese lady sitting beside me, and we sort of spoke our names back and forth and then relaxed, and we took off, and she kept looking at me, and she finally asked me, she said, "Excuse me, do you write books?" And I said, "Oh, yes, I've written 9 books so far, and I got 10 and 11 on their way out." And she said, "Ah, then that's you." I said, who, what? She said, "Every major bookstore in China has a big kiosk with your books on display."
Oh, that's great.
And they all have my picture in blatantly on the front of it, bearded and looking fierce. And it turned out that it's true. It's amazing. When I started to check with some of my Chinese friends, they said, "Oh, yes, all your books are at every bookstore." Of course, the Chinese government likes it very much because it's knocking mythology and superstition and that sort of thing. And they're very hard-headed when it comes to that sort of thing. So they like what I have to say.
You're a universal hero.
Well, it's hard to be in these days. You know, you have to wear the special costume and the whole thing. But no, I'm to get back to it though, Steve. Tam, carrying on. I think you're absolutely right with that, and I think if we can get a European or a UK Tam under us,
and that would be in addition to the annual one in the United
States.
Yes,
I believe so. Yes,
okay.
Mind you, that's a lot more work.
Yep.
A lot of it would have to be delegated.
You'd almost need a separate committee, like the European Tam committee.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we would have that certainly. Yeah. Yes, I think it would be probably centered in the UK. Because I have lots of good cooperative friends over there.
There are a lot of very excellent skeptics in the UK.
Oh, yes.
We have a lot of our listeners and supporters are out there in the UK.
Oh, really?
Is there anything else you want us to ask you about or talk about TAM?
One feature, yes. This year we'll be doing without Jerry Andrus. Jerry Andrus has died.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of folks who got to know him at TAM, this will be a great disappointment. But it shouldn't be. Jerry celebrated his life. When he called me on the phone, Steve, to tell me that he had a terminal condition, I broke down completely and unashamedly. And he was very disturbed. He kept on saying, "Oh, no, don't be sorry for me. Don't." And he commiserated with me in my sorrow at his passing.
Yeah.
He's the guy who's dying.
That's quite a
sign.
And
he's feeling concerned for me. Incredible. Well, not incredible if you know Jerry Andrus, of course. And he explained to me, he said, "Look," he said, "I've been everywhere I ever wanted to go, all over the world. I've met just about everybody I ever wanted to meet. I've seen everything. I've had a very, very rich life. It's time to go." Mm-hmm. That's the way Jerry looked at it.
Well,
so we're not going to mourn the passing of Jerry Andrus, but He's going to be at all the towns from now on because we have set aside a special table and a chair with a light on it and a photograph of Jerry and some of the props that Steve Bauer has been very good enough to come along with that represent the work that Jerry Andrus did. And they're going to be on display, and I'm going to call everybody's attention to it, and I'm just going to ask them that perhaps they'd like to walk by the table and just touch the picture, perhaps, mm-hmm. and just acknowledge that they know Jerry Andrus should be there, but isn't. So Jerry will be with us, will always be with us. He certainly, in my memory, he'll always be with me. Beautiful, beautiful person. I've never met anyone quite of that stature. Mm-hmm. So we're going to be commemorating Jerry Andrus, and I wish there were survival after death when it comes to this sort of thing,
yeah.
because then he'd be able to look down on us and smile, and he would, mm-hmm. because Jerry was a noble, noble man, the most honest man I ever knew, and a perfect example of a good, good human being.
So, Ray, it sounds like he was very comfortable with the fact that he had led a full life.
Oh, yes.
And he had no regrets.
Yep. And he said, I've got hospice people around me. He said, they're being very, very good yeah. to me. And he said, I have no regrets at all. He said, no, I've got everything in order. Got everything in order.
And the impression they get, and forgive me if this is too personal, but it sounds like you're pretty much in that space as well, in that you don't have any regrets about where your life or you've been everywhere, done so much.
No, I have no regrets at all. Yeah. No regrets whatsoever. I didn't meet Peter Ustinov, and I didn't meet Margaret Rutherford and a few other people like that. I did meet Arthur C. Clarke and Isaac Asimov and Richard Feynman and mm-hmm. Carl Sagan, all these. I mean, I've been very, very richly gifted with meeting these great, great people mm-hmm. who had a great influence on me, I must admit, too. I have been very fortunate to be able to rub shoulders with and even stay at the homes of old people like Richard Dawkins, for example. How rich an experience can that be? Mm-hmm. Wonderful, wonderful folks who have given me their time and their attention and to whom I might have contributed in some small way. I certainly hope so. So I have no regrets in that respect.
And Randy, I'm sure you don't need me to tell you this, and I'm sure you know this already, but you've had that kind of influence on an incredible number of people as well, just as you remember Isaac Asimov and Carl Sagan as being an incredible influence on you. You are that to vast, vast numbers of people, as you know, I think the attendance and the enthusiasm for TAM 6 shows.
Well, of course, we have the Randy doll out. They can always buy one of those and worship it, you know, in private with a small, a little decanter of wine wouldn't hurt, you know, and right beside it. I would say no, rum would be better.
Rum. So. All right. We'll note that. Well, Randy, thank you so much for spending some time with us. We greatly appreciate it. We're looking forward to a wonderful meeting.
All kinds of fun. And I'm looking forward to just seeing Linda at least flop into a chair and know that everything is actually launched.
Yeah, yeah.
That nice poor feeling. Lady, she really works hard for us, and we're looking forward to it, and we're glad that you're here, Steve.
Well, I appreciate you inviting me here. We're looking forward to all of us, to all of our participation at TAM.
Onwards and upwards. As Margaret Rutherford once said, forward to the fray like giants refreshed.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine, one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Is everyone ready for this week's challenge?
A panel of skeptics are ready.
Good. Here we go. Item number one. A new study finds that men vaccinated in the morning produce a better antibody response than those vaccinated in the afternoon. Item number two, a new fossil analysis suggests that relatively large brain size evolved independently in New World and Old World monkeys and is not a shared trait, as was previously thought. Number three, researchers have found that the pied flycatcher uses a primitive form of echolocation to help catch insects in flight. Rebecca, please do go first.
No.
Okay, next.
All right, you forfeit. Okay, Rebecca forfeits.
Rebecca says A. Next.
Okay, so a new study finding that men vaccinated in the morning produce a better antibody response than in the afternoon. That's tricky because it's just men and not women. Do women not have the same response? Or, I mean, that's That's kind of bizarre. Yeah.
And he could have just switched that fact right there, and that could be the trick.
Yeah, it could be that women vaccinated in the morning produce a better antibody.
Yeah, yeah, but in all fairness, I've never done anything that tricky or ridiculous. Yeah.
Define men.
On a side note, my cat just fell off the couch, and it was really funny.
That is a side note, yeah.
Okay. That does make sense to me, though, because, you know, your body changes over the course of a day. Stress might wear you down. I don't know. I know your feet get a little bigger at the end of the day. That's why you should always try on shoes at the end of the day. Otherwise, you'll get shoes that are too tight.
See, my underwear gets tighter as the day goes on.
So I think that could be true. Unless
you.
It's cold out, right? A new fossil analysis suggests that relatively large brain size evolved independently in New World and Old World monkeys. That makes sense, too. There are a lot of things that can evolve independently, large brains included, so that's plausible. The pied flycatcher, using a primitive form of echolocation to help catch insects in flight. See, I don't even know what a pied flycatcher is.
It's a Boyd.
Oh, it's another birder thing.
It's a
bird. A bird.
You didn't even have to look this one up, Rebecca.
Okay, the fact that this is a bird thing.
I had to balance the monkey thing with a bird thing.
Good point, Steve.
Thinking about that.
Well, you know, I'm
anxious to see who wins.
Of birds.
Or I had to balance the bird thing with the monkey thing. You could look at it either way.
See, now, while I can totally believe that different populations of monkeys are awesome enough to evolve giant brains, I am not quite as willing to accept that the pied flycatcher could use even a primitive form of echolocation. So even though that one seems plausible too, and I've heard of none of these, I'm just going to put that out there.
Yeah, very good
job this week, Steve. Or bad job on me. Maybe I just didn't read enough because, you know, my computer.
Okay, Rebecca,
was
it's time to move forward.
I heard your cat fell off the couch.
Excuses. Yeah.
Let's go.
and her shoes are too tight because she bought them in the morning.
Guys,
does anyone know what the price of tea in China is right now?
Ha ha ha. You know what's good in tea? Milk. And you know where milk comes from? Udders. Okay.
Oh my God.
So now that we've got all that out, I'm going to say that that the pied flycatcher does not use a primitive form of echolocation.
Okay, Jay, you go.
The pied flycatcher, it uses a primitive form of echolocation. Is there a modern form of echolocation? So that's the first thing I'll bring up, which makes me think that number three, the last one, is the fake. And, you know, it is plausible that birds could do that, but I would imagine that if a bird used echolocation, it would also have to have ears that can catch those very quiet sounds, and I've never seen a bird with big ears. I've never seen a bird with ears. So I think... there's holes in number three, the last one.
That's a good point. Do they just have holes in their head?
A new study finds that men vaccinated in the morning produce a better antibody response than those vaccinated in the afternoon. I've never heard anything about this either, but I don't know about that. I don't find any plausibility there either that I could, you know, can scrape out of the bottom of my head right now. I wouldn't think that there would be a dramatic difference between daytime and nighttime when somebody gets vaccinated. I think your body, you know, that would mean that if you're having a diminished response, that you're actually more susceptible to getting sick later in the day than you are earlier in the day. There's lots of questions there. I definitely think the one about the brains evolving independently, that's very plausible. So I'm going to say that the bird is the fake, the bird echolocation.
Okay, Evan?
Yeah, for the sake of brevity, I'll agree that the primitive form of echolocation doesn't sound right.
Okay.
Because I'm thinking back to...
Oh, you're abandoning the brevity now, but go ahead.
Yeah, no, well, that's my choice. So since birds, you know, came from dinosaurs and so forth, I'm trying to think if any dinosaurs had any sort of form of echolocation, but I can't say that anything rings a bell there. So, yeah. All right, Bob, it's all you.
Bob.
Let's see, the antibody response in the morning and the afternoon, the difference, that kind of makes sense to me. There's certain aspects of human physiology that will change as in the course of a day, like men are more prone to heart attacks for various reasons, like between 7 and 9 or in the morning, more heart attacks occur than any other time.
Because they're going to work.
Well, but so that doesn't surprise me that there'd be a bit. I mean, especially something as variable as your immune system and things. I could see that happening. Number two, the large brain size involving independently. I think that's called homologous evolution, and that's
that's analogous. Homologous is when they share it from a common ancestor. So if there was if New World and Old World monkeys had a common ancestor with the big brain, that
right.
would be homologous.
Homologous. Okay.
Yeah. So this would be analogous. They evolved it independently. Right.
Okay. Either way, I think there's so many examples of that's not surprising me. Even though we previously thought that it was homologous. So that sounds possible to me. The third one, Jay nailed this one. The ears is what's really doing it for me. And Jay, when he says that it's primitive, to me that means inefficient. So it could be primitive, and just slightly helpful would make it primitive in my eyes. And I can't see that even being primitive for them, because I'm not sure what bird hearing is like anyway, but it doesn't seem to me that it would be accurate enough to use even a primitive form of echolocation. So I'm going to say that is fiction.
So you guys, last week you were all over the place. This week you all agree that number three, the pied flycatcher, is the fiction. Let's actually start.
We decide to stand together.
Let's start with number two. New fossil analysis suggests that relatively large brain size evolved independently in New World and Old World monkeys. It is not a shared trait, as was previously thought. That one is science, as you all surmised. And this was actually not new fossils. This was just a new analysis of existing fossils, looking at the relative brain size of New World and Old World monkeys. New World, of course, being largely in South America. Old World being in Africa and Asia. They are two different branches. They're definitely all related. They're all monkeys. But and it was thought that since they are all related, that any traits that they have in common, they probably derived from their common ancestor. That's the obvious assumption. So it was a little surprising to find that. Oh wow! If you look at New World monkeys, meaning like monkeys fossils from New World monkeys shortly after they split off from the Old World monkeys, they had small brains. And so do the Old World monkeys. So their larger, relatively large brains evolved independently. That was a bit surprising.
How'd they miss that?
I guess they just didn't have, a thorough enough analysis of the fossils of the primitive monkeys. Let's go to number three. You guys all agree that researchers have found that the pied flycatcher uses a primitive form of echolocation to help catch insects in flight. You all thought that this one was the fiction, but this one is fiction.
Woohoo!
Oh, congratulations.
You can't fiction.
Now, but hang on.
Your little cliffhanger.
Ding, ding, ding.
I do have to take a little exception with some of your reasoning, though.
Okay.
But, so, first of all,
this is going to result in a long, boring talk.
Here we go.
Absolutely.
Go get a drink.
Jay, I like your logic that using echolocation would require big ears, and you've never seen a bird with big ears. That logic is good as far as it goes. However, you neglected to consider the owl. Owls actually have superb hearing, and yet they only have holes for ears.
No, they have ears.
They only have holes for ears. No, those are not ears, Jay. Those are tufts of feathers that look like ears.
No shit.
Oh, really?
That's right. The owl ears.
Bob is astounded.
Those are ears.
Bob fell off his chair.
At least in most species of owls. Actually.
Now, wait, Steve. You're saying that those tufts of feathers don't help funnel sound?
That's right. They're
no
just
shit.
Horns. Yeah, they're not ears. They're just feathery little tufts.
Wow! Who knows that? That's incredible. I thought those.
Listen to this.
Googling that.
Their face. Their facial disc. Yeah. Mm-hmm. That is what funnels the sound to their ears.
Oh my god!
That whole thing's like a big radar dish, and they have incredible hearing.
And they swoop down on my horsey.
They do so that. So your logic breaks down a little bit there. They could have something other than ears that's funneling the sound. And birds make lots of high-pitched chirps and stuff that could be reasonably used. In fact, I had to look this one up to make sure I didn't miss something. It's always hard to prove the negative, but I couldn't find anything with the pied flycatcher. Also, primitive, as Bob said, not as good as what bats have, something that kind of works okay, but it's not as sophisticated and as evolved, as tweaked as, say, bat echolocation is what I had in mind. I did derive this from a real very cool story about the pied flycatcher, actually. What researchers did find is that the flycatcher, as well as the same is true of some species of the red-winged blackbird, is that they defend themselves by mobbing predators. So if one bird gets attacked, they let out a warning cry, and then all of the flycatchers in the area will attack the predator at the same time. They'll mob them and scare them off.
Cool.
What they found was that if a flycatcher gives the warning signal and then another flycatcher doesn't respond to the call, when that other flycatcher gives the warning signal, the original one won't respond either. But he will respond to other flycatchers that also did respond. So in other words, he will reward help by helping himself and will punish those who didn't help by not listening to their calls into the future. So there's the same kind of system of sort of justice and rewards and tit for tat that exists, say, in humans.
So they hold grudges.
I did a quick search on owls, and I'm looking at pictures, and I'm a little surprised to see that there's a ton of different kinds of owls that just don't have any ear type thing sticking up. Like most of them have flat faces and really big, like round feathers coming off their face.
Yeah, that's their hearing dish. That's right.
That's cool.
And some have feathery horns that people confuse for ears. That's right. Okay, so that was the pied flycatcher. Very cool research. And all of this means that, number one, a new study finds that men vaccinated in the morning produce a better antibody response than those vaccinated in the afternoon. Is science. And yeah, that's somewhat plausible that different hormonal levels in different times of the day,
maybe
they're able to
the
more
morning.
Vigorously produce a response in the morning than the afternoon. And this research, the same study did not show the same effect for women. That's why I had to put men in there. So Rebecca, you picked up on that. It's true. It was true for men, but not women. And this study included, on the order of magnitude of a couple of hundred subjects. And then if you think you're splitting it out for men and women. So it was a smallish study. This is certainly far from definitive or conclusive. And the fact that it was for men and for not women means that it could just be a statistical fluke in this one study. So it definitely needs follow-up to show, is this a real effect or not? You need to do this more prospectively. But interesting, if it pans out, that's sort of interesting. And it may, it has a very, very practical implication, get vaccinated in the morning, not the afternoon.
Yep.
And you'll have a more vigorous response.
So,
it's interesting.
So, Steve, you're saying in this particular study, it did show that, but it's not...
I don't want to leave listeners with the impression that this is definitely true. This was a definitive study. This was a smaller study, and it needs to be followed up to be confirmed. It's more of a hypothesis generating kind of study than a definitive study.
Yep.
But good work, everyone. You guys sniffed
thanks,
out the
Steve.
Fake.
Thanks, Steve. Yeah, thanks, Steve.
I included these more because I thought the discussion would be interesting.
Oh, yeah.
But I had to, I had a monkey in there. I had to have a bird, something in there. I had to have both for balance. Jay.
Yeah.
Can you please regale us with your finely picked quote?
Yeah, I actually have one tonight. I actually like to pick quotes now that have to do with our topic during the show. So sometimes I'm feverishly looking for quotes that contains a little nugget of something we discussed. And I think this one is kind of relevant to one of our earlier discussions.
It's about owls. I hope
no.
It's about owls.
Didn't have time because we just did science or fiction.
Hmm.
This is a quote from
Slacker.
the author and illustrator of Dilbert, Scott Adams. When did ignorance become a point of view?
Which one could apply to Scott Adams?
Scott Adams!
That's definitely a pithy quote.
You can't actually still giggle every time I do it, Rebecca. Is it still funny?
It's still funny. It's still funny. But I really do need to...
Develop the charm all its own.
Point out that Scott Adams is a... friggin' creationist.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
I thought that was relevant because...
it's still a good quote.
What I realized after finding this quote was that, ignorance truly is a point of view today. It's legitimized as something that we're supposed to... that people want us to teach our children. It's infused in our government. It's infused in our healthcare.
Yeah. As you bring this back to the healthcare discussion, fraud... and magic is now a legitimate alternative. How did that happen? How did the con artists win? It's incredible.
How did Roswell become so ingrained in our culture and society?
I don't know.
Yep, it's messed up. Okay.
But we'll keep fighting the good fight. Fear not.
Yep.
Speaking of, I have two fun announcements.
Uh-huh.
Hit it.
That I wanted to get to.
Hit
okay.
It.
One, I have been terribly remiss in mentioning that the Skeptic calendars are for sale now, and they are totally rad. Lots of sexy people. We have the Skeptics and the Skeptudes. If you want to check them out, head over to skeptic.org, and there's a link at the top. It says pinup calendars. You click on that. You can see them. You can order them, and it's fun. Everybody's doing it. The other thing is also Skeptic related. We are having a Skeptic meetup coming up in a few weeks, July 26th, Saturday, July 26th. Five Skeptic bloggers will be in New York City hanging out, and we'd love for a bunch of people to come out. And I'm trying to get Jay and Evan to possibly come as well. Fellas, what do you think?
I have a birthday party.
Rebecca, if I am absolutely available, I will come. If there's any way I can squeeze it in, I will be there. But this is like an afternoon/evening event, correct?
Yep.
So are we gonna let hanging out and squeeze it in just go on by without making any comments?
No, Jay's going to get a lot of abuse from me and from fans
too easy.
Who are in New York right now who are planning to come to this. We're going to write in and browbeat them into coming along because
right.
It's going to be fun. Lori Lipman Brown is speaking in New York for the New York City Skeptics at 1 p.m.
Nice.
In Manhattan. And then we will be gathering shortly after that, like as a fun after party. Go on Skeptic and there'll be details there.
Awesome. Cool. And our YouTube videos are doing well. We have over 1,200 views as of this recording. That's just after a few days. Not exactly awesome. What I would call going viral, but a good start. So
Steve,
if you haven't looked at them
thing.
Yet, go
just
to...
needs to kiss more people.
That's
Steve,
true.
Asking for a video to go viral never
I think
makes
I pointed that out last week. Just let him go.
I'm not asking for it to go viral.
One can
I'm
help.
Asking for our listeners to just give them a look. Just take a look at the YouTube videos. Give us some feedback.
Just look at it.
You know, maybe email it to
viral.
Two or a few hundred friends.
Yeah. I want
That's all I'm asking.
Go viral.
And then we'll just let nature take its course.
What I would like our listeners to do, if anyone hears a particular segment that they like, that they think would fit the YouTube video format, give us a heads up because we can't listen to our whole backlog or whatever. But people that are listening to different episodes, that'd be great if you just said, hey, in this episode, this segment was really good. I think it would work on YouTube. We'd appreciate it.
Meaning it has a really visual component to it. And if you are really motivated, send us the pictures that would go along with what we're talking about. And again, don't forget about our other podcast, 5x5. Take a listen.
And both the links for the 5x5 and our new YouTube videos are on the Skeptic's Guide homepage.
Which is
and thank you.
At theskepticsguide.org.
That's right.
Can't wait to see the new
Thanks
one.
Thanks again for joining me, everyone.
Thank you.
Good times.
Thanks,
good
Steve.
Times.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
Dang. Na 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 na
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation and Skeptic.org. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. For questions, suggestions, and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by voting for us on Dig or leaving us a review on iTunes. You can find links to these sites and others through our homepage. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission.